Nobody arrests nobody. Keep the whole thing a mystery, am I right? I moved forward on the bed, enough to shield Amy, who couldn't speak, who was shaking uncontrollably. "You'll never get away with this," I said.
"Get away with what?" he answered. "My name's not in the little black book. And this thing with Kate? Hey, I was never here."
His smile never reached his cold eyes, appearing and disappearing from his lips.
"Here's what happened, detective, and listen carefully, because your life depends on it."
He raised a hand.
"Kate walked in and caught you and Amy together. She was jealous. She pulled out her gun to kill you both, but you got off a shot first. You killed her in self-defense."
He looked down at Kate.
"That's a story everyone will believe. I'll make sure they believe it. They won't even charge you."
He walked back over to the bed, watching Amy and me. "And Ramona De La Vu?" I said. "And Joe Washington?" His head bobbed back and forth.
"Desperate times call for desperate measures. But they won't come back to me either, my friend. If you push things, I think what you'll find is that those murders will come back to you."
"You framed me for those too?" He shrugged.
"Insurance," he said. "In case you got too nosy, I don't want you in prison, pal. I want you by my side."
My mind was racing, looking for angles, anything. We were sitting ducks on this bed, unarmed and unable to make any meaningful attempt at fighting back.
"So that's out of the way," he said. "Then there's the matter of the little black book. Somebody took a copy from Margaret Olson's safe last night. And Margaret tells me that only one person had a key to her office. And that same person knew that Margaret had a safe hidden underneath her desk."
Goldie turned his gun, my gun, and trained it on Amy.
"That would be you, Ms. Lentini. So do me a favor and hand it over, if you would."
102. Goldie gestured with the gun and said it again.
"The little black book, Amy. If you please."
I realized that Goldie hadn't heard what Amy told me tonight in the apartment. I'd destroyed the bug I'd found in the living room, and the music Amy had turned on in the bedroom blocked out the bug in here. So Goldie didn't know that somebody had broken into Amy's apartment and stolen the little black book. He thought Amy still had it.
"I made copies," Amy said, which was smart of her, but unlikely to work on a guy like Goldie.
He snickered, showed some teeth.
"Sure you did," he said. "And if you don't say the word by midnight, copies are going out to all the news stations in town, right? Come on now, Amy, give it up. Or I'm gonna have to do the same thing to you that I did to Kate."
It was clear to me then that he was going to do that anyway. He couldn't let Amy live. Not after this. He might think he could convert me, but Amy?
"Don't tell him," I said to Amy. "The moment you do, you die."
"No,"
Goldie, showing the first sign of angst.
"No. If I get back the little black book, she can live. She can't hurt me. She'll have nothing. My word against hers. Margaret's word against hers."
He looked squarely at me.
"Your word against hers."
"Not mine," I said. "I'm not lying for you."
I started to push myself off the bed. Goldie shook his head and pointed the gun at me.
"Don't move, Billy. Not until I can talk some goddamn sense into you."
"You kill her," I said. "You'll have to kill me too."
"Jesus Christ, kid. Why should I have to do that? Just give me Amy's copy and I have the original. There won't be a little black book anymore. Don't you get it? Everything will work out fine. Margaret's going to be mayor. She's going to dump that idiot Tristan Driscoll and appoint—"
He stopped on that. "Appoint who?" I asked.
"She's going to make you the new police superintendent? Was that the deal you cut with Margaret?"
Goldie's shoulders rose and fell.
"Didn't have much of a choice. I didn't want to cut any deal with that bitch. But I didn't have a choice. I didn't give her the damn thumb drive."
"Right. I got it now."
"Ramona De La Vu did," I said. "She was trying to cut a deal for immunity with Margaret. Ramona admitted it to you after you tortured it out of her."
Goldie smirked.
"Ramona. She was a tough broad," he said. Held out a long time.
Then why didn't Margaret just make it public once she had it? I asked. Tedesco's name was in that book. He'd be ruined.
Goldie shook his head.
Smart a guy as you are, kiddo. You never did think like a politician, did you?
Amy cleared her throat. If Margaret made it public and outed Tedesco, then Tedesco wouldn't endorse Margaret, she said. And he wouldn't give her his campaign war chest. Margaret couldn't win without those things. The little black book was more powerful as a threat, as blackmail.
Goldie wagged a finger.
See? There you go, Amy. You're a politician already. I'm sure Mayor Margaret Olson will have a nice cozy spot for you in the office.
He drew a breath.
Yeah, I went to Margaret. I had the original, and she had the only copy, so we made a deal.
He seemed almost proud of it.
Enough, he said. Amy, I need that thumb drive. Give it to me, and we all live happily ever after. You both have great careers ahead of you. You'll get married and have beautiful babies, and everything will be swell. On the other hand, you don't tell me. Well, I gotta put a bullet in Billy's kneecap.
No, I said. Don't tell him.
And you don't tell me after that. I put one in his other kneecap. We keep going till your boyfriend looks like a fucking piñata.
Don't, Amy, I said. No matter what, don't tell him.
Goldie looked at each of us, his bravado wavering. He gave me a cross look and shook his head.
I'll cop to it, I said. I'll say I was the dirty cop. I took the payoffs from Ramona De La Vue. I'll admit it, Goldie. Just let Amy go. Let Amy walk out of here, and you have my word, on my daughter's grave, that I'll take the fall. You already have my name in the little black book anyway, right?
A wave passed through me. I thought about what I'd just said, and it didn't make sense. I could see Goldie doctoring the little black book and putting my name in it to frame me, sure. But that didn't account for the copy Ramona had made on the thumb drive. Ramona had given Margaret that copy. And she did it without Goldie's knowledge. Goldie only found out about it later, after he tortured Ramona. So how could Goldie have doctored the copy that Amy had found in Margaret's safe? How could my name have been in the copy?
Not your name specifically, Amy said. You never let me finish.
I wanted to turn to her, but I couldn't take my eyes off Goldie.
There were no first names in the book, only last names, Amy said. The cop taking the payoff had the last name Harney. That's all it said, Harney.
I closed my eyes a moment, sucked in a breath.
Not Billy Harney, just Harney.
That's when I knew who had broken into Amy's apartment and stolen the little black book. It was Patty. Goldie raised his chin, turned his head toward the window. His voice louder, he said,
"We're not getting anywhere. You better come in here and talk some sense into him."
103. The present. I take a breath and pause. The clock over the jury box says it's almost noon. Right about now, the judge should be looking for a logical point to take a break so the jurors can have their lunch, and more important, so he can have his own lunch. But the judge has hardly moved, his eyes narrowed in concentration, fixed on a space somewhere between me and my lawyer. The jurors are all leaning forward. Some of them have been filling their notebooks with scribbles, but most of them have dispensed with the note-taking and have settled into positions best suited for viewing the horror show. It's so quiet inside this courtroom that you can hear the breathing from the spectators' gallery, the collective inhales and exhales. Lieutenant Mike Goldberger, initially shaking his head in mock disbelief, has slowly transformed during my testimony. His eyes now cold, his shoulders drawn in, his fists clenched. He is trapped in the courtroom, essentially. If he runs away, he looks guilty. He looks pretty damn guilty right now anyway. But I know what he's thinking. This is only Billy's word. His word against mine. That's Goldie. It always was. Always calculating. Always seeing every angle. My father, sitting next to him, eyes me intently, some fingers covering his mouth, unsure how to act.
Margaret Olsen, like Goldie, even more so than Goldie, is a prisoner in this courtroom. She's the prosecutor, after all. She can't just storm out. She has essentially never stopped shaking her head during my almost 3 hours of testimony as she watches her political career swirl down the toilet as she considers every possible angle to salvage it. Ultimately, I assume, she's thinking the same thing as Goldie. It's his word against mine, the word of a desperate defendant looking at life in prison who will say anything, no matter how far-fetched, to save his own ass. My lawyer, Stilson, has forgotten his role and has listened along with the jurors, the reporters, the curious onlookers. So Lieutenant Goldberger said, "You better come in here and talk some sense into him?" "Yes," I answered. He was saying it to someone not in the room. He was speaking toward the recording device in the room, wherever it was. Stilson, whose first instinct all morning has been to simply ask what happened next, instead cocks his head. "You said you knew at that moment that it was Patty who stole the thumb drive from Amy's apartment."
"Yes."
"How?"
I looked at her, my twin sister, as still as a statue, but I could see it in the sheen of her eyes, the single tear that had fallen. I could almost see the bubble over her head saying, "I'm sorry. I'm so sorry."
"Because Patty would have seen the name Harney on that page of the little black book and assumed it was me," I said. "Her first instinct would have been to protect me, to steal the little black book and destroy it."
Fresh tears streamed down Patty's face.
"This whole time since the shootings, while I was in a coma, when I came out and slowly recovered, as I considered how to defend myself against these charges, she's thought I was the dirty cop. This whole time she's been trying to protect me, even though she was sure I was guilty. She tried to protect me."
I choke up on those last words, take a moment, clear my throat.
"She loves me, and she'd do anything for me," I say. "But she worships our father. She never in a million years would have considered the possibility that the name Harney could mean another cop. She never would have suspected that the chief of detectives, Daniel Harney, was the dirty cop."
Patty jumps out of her seat in the front row, her mouth open, pure horror on her face. She turns to my father, whose eyes are now focused on the floor before him.
"A second chance," Pop said to me the other day when he tried to persuade me to flee the jurisdiction to escape to Mexico. "You have a second chance. I have a second chance."
I'd like to think he was sincere when he said that. That he really was going to try to slip me out of the country to Playa del Carmen, then South America. That he wasn't going to put a bullet in my brain somewhere between Chicago and the Mexican border. I'd like to believe that he was hoping for that second chance. But I didn't take it. And so he sent someone to my house last night to try to kill me for the second time. And now, I'll never know for sure, because I will never speak another word to him.
104. The Past. By the time my father walked into the bedroom, joining Goldie, I knew that Amy would never get off that bed alive. They might think they could co-opt me into going along with a plan. But Amy? She had seen too much. She'd spent her career being a by-the-book prosecutor, straight as an arrow. And she wasn't blood, wasn't family. They couldn't trust her to keep quiet. They couldn't let her live.
"I'm so sorry I ever doubted you,"
Amy whispered on a trembling breath.
"I'm sorry I doubted you," I said. "I love you, Amy. I love you so much."
My father entered the bedroom then, looked down at Kate as he walked in, the way he might glance at a homeless person he passed on the street. I didn't expect him to be surprised. He had obviously been listening to everything through the eavesdropping device planted in the room. He shook his head as if disappointed.
"Congratulations, Pop," I said. "Let me guess. Margaret's going to make you the superintendent, and the deputy superintendent will be Mike Goldberger."
My father blinked several times, always the stoic demeanor.
"If you're going to ask me to apologize for providing for my family all these years, I won't."
"Providing for your family through bribes and extortion?"
"Son, you don't—"
And last I checked,
Mom's been gone for years, and all your kids are grown up. So who the fuck have you been providing for other than yourself? My father wasn't kidding. He wasn't going to apologize. Not because he didn't have regret. He just didn't like to show weakness. He put out a hand.
I didn't want it to turn out this way. But it's not too late for you, son. It's not too late for us. Goldie was right. You can have any job in the department you want. You and Amy, you can be happy together.
He might have had more success had he left out that last sentence, the lie about Amy staying alive. But deep down, if he knew me at all, he knew I wouldn't go along with him and Goldie, which meant these words weren't meant as a plea to me. They were meant as salve for his guilt, so he could tell himself before he killed me, after he killed me, for the rest of his life, that he gave me one last chance. I moved directly in front of Amy, put out my arms behind me to barricade her in.
They're gonna kill me either way, she whispered into my ear. But they don't want to kill you. Save yourself, Billy. Say whatever you have to say.
No, I whispered, shaking so hard I could barely speak.
Patty needs you, son, my father said. You know how she relies on you. She's always leaned on you.
Don't make me do this.
Get on board here.
My eyes bored into his. I should have felt fear. Instead, I felt nothing but pure hatred.
Never, I said.
Amy's head resting between my shoulder blades, her heartbeat pounding into my spine, her entire body hidden behind mine, my arms behind me, trying to envelop her.
I love you so much, she whispered to me.
The only time she'd ever said the words to me, as my father moved toward Kate and lifted her gun from her dead hand. My father moving closer, holding Kate's gun. Goldie next to him, holding mine. Goldie had already laid out the plan, the jilted lover theory. It would still work for them, I realized. Kate barging in a jealous rage, a gunfight ensuing. But my father, holding Kate's gun, would have to shoot me. They couldn't sell that story if I were shot with my own weapon. I moved one hand from Amy and reached for my phone, touched it. My father's eyes moved to it.
His phone, said my father.
Not to me, but to Goldie. A reminder that they'd have to dispose of it, take it with them or smash it to pieces.
Move away from the girl, my father said. It doesn't have to be both of you, son.
Never, I said again.
Jesus, Billy. She's worth that much to you, huh? So much that you're willing to die along with her?
I looked into my father's eyes. Had he ever known love? Love that went beyond love for himself and his own advancement. I didn't know. I hoped so, for my mother's sake. I would never know for sure. All I knew was that I had found Amy, and I couldn't ever let her go. I couldn't live without her.
You always were the soft-hearted one, Pop said to me. I never understood it.
Behind me, Amy scooted sideways, separating herself from me. I reached for her, grabbed her arm, tried to stop her. But she had moved out from behind me before I could. She was doing what they wanted, making it easier for them to kill her, but not me. We looked at each other for a moment, probably only one tick of the clock by any objective measure, but it felt like we held that stare forever. So much courage in her eyes, so much love.
Shirt off, Amy, said Goldie.
She did what they asked. It would make the story easier. We were in bed fooling around when Kate stormed in. I didn't want her to help them, but we were stalling, hanging on to precious seconds, and I needed the distraction. Because I had one last move. It was a long shot. The way I was seated on the bed, my legs out in front of me, made my ability to spring forward almost non-existent, and Pop wasn't dumb enough to get so close to me that I could reach out and grab the gun. But I was out of good choices. I clenched the muscles in my calves and thighs, tried to shift my balance forward without being too obvious, while Amy pulled her shirt over her head. I thought of my beautiful little daughter, taken so young, those angelic eyes beaming up at me, and told her that I would see her soon. Then I placed my hands on the bed and prepared to spring off it. There was only one way this could possibly succeed. I was counting on one thing, and only one thing.
I was counting on my father not being able to shoot his own son.
105. The present. I stare at the floor as Dilson Tomita struggles for the next question. I don't want to look at Patty, who was ordered by the sheriff's deputy to sit back down. I don't want to look at my father either. He didn't hesitate, I say. He knew I was going to make a move on him. He shot me before I had the chance. Amy must have... She probably turned away by instinct, and my blood spattered on her bare back. For their purposes, it laid the scene out perfectly. I wipe at my face. The courtroom rings with utter silence. I wish I'd died right then, but I didn't. They killed Amy, too, says Stilson, a choke in his voice. I nod. Eventually, so the doctors tell me, my brain and heart clicked off for a while before I came back to life, but I didn't check out right away. I heard what they did to Amy. I couldn't see anything at that point, but for some reason, I could still hear.
Amy, this can still turn out okay for you, said Goldie. They shot each other. You were an innocent bystander.
Just give us the thumb drive, and we're on our way, said my father. I heard her voice as though it were far away, a muted low mumble. I could hear Amy's desperate whispers. Incline, O Lord, thine ears to our prayers, in which we humbly beseech thy mercy, that thou would place the soul of thy servant Billy, which thou hast caused to depart from this world.
Amy, work with me here. Focus. Give us the little black book.
But Amy was no longer listening, as these two predators closed in on her, ready to steal away her life at any second. Amy wasn't thinking of herself. She was thinking of me. She was praying for my soul.
We don't want to shoot you, Amy.
I had forgotten how to pray after I lost my wife and daughter. I had rejected God and lost my faith. But now I prayed. Inside my wrecked brain, I prayed that Amy's death would come quickly and without pain. I prayed that God would take Amy into his kingdom and surround her with all the love she deserved.
She's not going to talk, said my father. It's in here somewhere. We'll find it. Just get on with it.
I felt no pain. I felt nothing but Amy's love wrapped around me, the warmth spreading through me. I didn't feel the touch of her hand or her breath on my face or her lips on mine. I felt all of her, all at once. I heard the gunshot, the startled gasp escaping Amy's mouth. And then I heard nothing at all. I look up at Stilson Tomita through blurry eyes, my face soaked with tears, unable to speak, my heartbeat banging against my shirt. Right now, I feel her again. I'm filled with her. A feeling that wants to be pain, but I won't let it hurt. She wouldn't want that. Amy would want me to feel the joy of her love, not the sadness. I will never forget you, Amy. I will move on because I know you want me to, but you will always be part of me. Stilson Tomita clears his throat, wipes at his eyes. No further questions, Your Honor, he says.
106.
Maximum Margaret Olson moves from the prosecutor's table and slithers toward me, her eyes on me, filled with hatred. This trial has been about me. I've had to fight for my life. But now this trial is about something else, too. It's about Margaret Olson, front runner in the race for Chicago mayor. In every way that counts, she is now fighting for her life, too.
That was quite a story, Mr. Harney. Lots of revelations.
She makes a show with her hands.
Little black books and cover-ups. But let me see if I understand this.
She stops only a foot away from me, puts her hands on the wooden frame of the witness stand, bracing herself, leaning forward toward me. I'm half expecting a serpent's tongue to lash out and pluck out my eyeballs. It's all I can do not to lunge forward and grab her throat. Margaret didn't commit murder. But her ambition and corruption were part of this, too. She is just as much to blame as my father and Goldie.
Amy Lentini isn't here to corroborate your testimony, is she?
I inhale and exhale.
I'm in a court of law, and I'm still on trial. I think of Amy, and what she would want. Her by-the-book, respect-the-law way. Fine, Margaret. I can hurt you without ever laying a finger on you.
No, Amy is not here, I say, drawing out the words.
Neither is Kate Fenton, is she?
No.
Now that they're dead, you can say whatever you want about them, can't you?
If you say so.
And I assume that two of the most decorated members of the Chicago Police Department, Chief of Detectives Daniel Harney and the Chief of the Bureau of Internal Affairs Michael Goldberger can...
I'm sure they'll deny everything, I say. She didn't expect me to agree so readily.
And when the police searched the crime scene afterward, they didn't find any eavesdropping devices, did they?
No, they would be easy to remove.
The point is, there's no evidence of that, is there?
That's correct, Ms. Olson.
She nods, feeling a little adrenaline now, scoring some points, finally getting to fight back after I testified for 4 agonizing hours. And nobody ever found a little black book, did they? I mean, there's no proof it ever existed, is there?
I look over at my sister, Patty, in the front row, who has her face in her hands. At this last question, her face pops back up and peeks at me through her splayed fingers.
I say, I don't have a copy of the little black book, if that's what you mean. My guess is that both the original and the thumb drive have been destroyed. How convenient, Olson says.
Not for me, it isn't.
So, no witnesses to corroborate? No little black book to corroborate?
Correct.
So this whole thing, she says.
And with that, her hands leave the witness box, and she turns toward the jury, toward the gallery, toward the reporters who have breathlessly tweeted out these juicy, scandalous revelations.
This entire thing you've just told us, we only have your word to take for it.
She pauses on that. I clear my throat. Margaret, I recorded the whole thing on my smartphone. She does a half turn in my direction, as if afraid to fully confront what I've just said. My sister was good enough to install an icon on my phone so I can just hit one button and start recording. I hit it when Goldie first walked into the apartment, and Kate's head turned away from me for a moment. One touch, and it started recording. And just before my father shot me, I touched the icon again to stop it. By now, Margaret has retreated to the prosecution's table, where she is huddling with her team. They're showing her something in a manila folder, whispering to her feverishly. Finally, she looks up at me.
Your phone was smashed in the bedroom, she says. Destroyed. Nothing could be recovered from the physical phone, right?
Right.
You're aware that we tried very hard to penetrate that phone and couldn't.
Yes.
And you didn't have one of those save to the cloud functions, did you? The platform that allows you to store records in cyberspace.
No, I didn't. I'm pretty clueless when it comes to those phones. If it wasn't for the icon Patty installed, I never could have recorded anything.
So this recording you tell us about, it wasn't recovered from your physical phone, and it's not on any cloud.
Correct.
So once again, Mr. Harney, says the prosecutor, fully recovered, her arms out in a theatrical gesture. We have only your word to take for these claims you've made here today.
I look 3 rows back in the gallery and make eye contact with Stuart's daughter, Grace, who was kind enough to show up today after I called her this morning. Grace gives me a sweet smile.
Her father, my good friend Stuart, had died by the time I made the recording in Amy's bedroom.
With Stuart deceased, and with my having no memory of recording what happened in the bedroom, nobody else in the world would have bothered to check that private Facebook page that Stuart and I shared, the one to which I uploaded all my jokes and comedy routines with one click of an icon. I certainly wouldn't. Why would I want to listen to a bunch of my old jokes? And Grace wouldn't. There were no memories of her father on that page, just a bunch of one-liners and humorous observations, and sometimes a few minutes of stand-up at the hole in the wall. It was between Stuart and me, nobody else. All this time,
The audio recording was posted right there on that private Facebook page. I think Grace enjoys the fact that even after his death, Stuart was able to lend me a hand in my moment of need. I do too. I feel his presence now. The man who comforted me while my daughter was dying. The man who was more of a father to me in the short time I knew him than my real father ever was. The courtroom erupts when I mention my smartphone's automatic link to Stuart's Facebook page. When the reporters and jurors realize that sometime soon they're going to get hold of that recording and be able to listen to what transpired blow by blow in that bedroom. Needless to say, Margaret Olson, Goldie, and my father don't take the news very well. 107. With 27% of the precincts reporting in the special mayoral election, WGN News is now projecting that County Commissioner Estefan Morales will become the first Latino mayor of Chicago. As we stand in my family room watching the TV, we four Harney kids clink our beer bottles together and take a congratulatory swig. We don't quite smile at one another. We haven't done a lot of smiling in these last 3 weeks. We've cried, argued, denied, and questioned. We've mourned, accused, and hugged. And we've drunk enough beer to fill a small reservoir. The tremendous fall of Margaret Olson, the Cook County State's Attorney and one-time favorite in the race, finishing in a disappointing sixth place. It's not exactly a huge shock that Margaret didn't win. The polls were suggesting as much. I mean, it's kind of hard to run a campaign with the slogan, "I didn't kill or blackmail anyone, I swear." You have to admire Margaret for having the brass to continue the campaign at all after my trial and the release of the audio recording. "Wasn't just the contents of that audio recording, Mark. I think what really did Olson in was the fact that she didn't act on it over the last 3 weeks since it surfaced. She didn't file charges against the officers implicated on that recording." "Agree with Linda, Mark. I think voters thought Margaret Olson was dragging out any further investigation until today, hoping that her denials would be enough to get her through this election." Let's turn to the newest member of our team, Kim Beans. Kim, no reporter was closer to this scandal than you. Your thoughts? Kim Beans, looking well scrubbed and beautiful, having benefited mightily from the suffering of many, looks into the camera. "I think you're all correct to an extent," she says. "I do think Margaret Olson still had a hope of pulling out this election. But the real reason she did basically nothing about this audio recording over the last 3 weeks? More than anything else, what was the real reason?" "She wanted Pop and Goldie to run," I say. "I think Margaret was hoping that officers Daniel Harney and Michael Goldberger would run," she says. "She wanted them to flee the jurisdiction, which they were perfectly free to do as long as they hadn't been charged with a crime. She wanted them to run so there was no evidence against her other than a vague audio recording. She didn't just want to win an election. She wants to stay out of prison." Patty runs a hand through her hair and blows out air like she's inflating a balloon, dark circles prominent under her eyes. Our sister was particularly crushed by her father's betrayal. Aiden and Brendan had never had as close a relationship to Pop, and they didn't follow in his footsteps as a cop or even stay in Chicago. Whatever grief they're feeling, they've channeled into helping Patty. It's like when your first parent dies and all focus shifts to the surviving parent. So we've made Patty our project. Aiden, the musclehead, always trying to tussle with her or lift her off her feet, which makes her laugh only because it's so juvenile, or maybe because it reminds her of our childhood. Brendan, with the off-color humor that Patty always enjoyed. The three of us have made an unspoken pact over these last 3 weeks to stay near her, one of us always keeping an eye on her. It's been our assignment. The distraction has been helpful. It's easier to focus on someone else's grief than cope with your own. I put my hand on her shoulder and lower my head, look directly into her eyes. I want to tell her, "We'll get through this," or "It's gonna be okay." But I don't have to say the words. It's a twins thing. That's about the only way I can put it. My sister kept a lot of secrets and did a lot of things, all to protect me. Did she enjoy it on some level, being the strong one for once? Being the one to help me instead of the other way around? I'm sure she did. but it doesn't change the fact that she was there for me. She thought I was the dirty cop, the Harney in the little black book, and she thought I was guilty of 4 murders. But she still stood by me. We are family, and we always will be. Where do you think they went? She whispers under her breath, words intended only for me, not Aiden or Brendan. I shrug. Does it matter? The audio recording I'd made, which, by the way, has now received more than 3 million hits on the Facebook page put up by my lawyer Stilson, should have been all Margaret needed to arrest both Pop and Goldie. But she dragged her feet, refusing to comment, citing the old ongoing investigation excuse. Kim Beans on television just now was spot on about that. Margaret dragged her feet to give Pop and Goldie a chance to run. It would be hard to make a case against Margaret based only on that audio recording. If the star witnesses were sunning themselves on a beach in South America, she could probably avoid being prosecuted. And it worked. A few days after the audio recording surfaced, Pop and Goldie went adios. They picked a Friday night when the work week was over and they wouldn't be missed at the office. Smart. They were always smart. Patty gives me a long look, takes a deep breath, and releases. Maybe it's just another twin intuition thing, but it seems like something is lifted off her shoulders. You're right. It doesn't matter where he went, she says. He's gone either way.
Hey! Aiden shouts. Enough of the serious whispering. Time for another group hug!
He's big enough by himself to draw the three of us in. Patty rolls her eyes, but she enjoys it, I know. So the four of us Harneys draw together in a tight embrace. For just that moment, it feels like we're kids again in our backyard, when everything was simple and the future limitless. 108.
United States versus Michael Leonard Goldberger, the clerk calls out. United States versus Daniel Collins Harney.
Margaret Olson had given Pop and Goldie a head start on an escape, but there's another gang of prosecutors in town who wear federal badges. The U.S. Attorney's Office loves to prosecute local cops. No way they were going to pass on this case. Federal agents found Pop and Goldie in Playa del Carmen, Mexico. The word is that when the marshals kicked in the door, Pop was halfway out a bathroom window and Goldie was hiding under the bed. From a side door, Goldie and my father appear, dressed in orange jumpsuits, escorted by federal marshals, their hands in shackles. Patty draws a quick breath. So do I. Goldie has shaved his head altogether and grown a goatee. His eyes briefly scan the room before they move downward. And my father. His hair is a different color, a bright red, and it's the first time I can remember seeing a rough blanket of whiskers on his face. His eyes are so dark, it's as if he's wearing a mask. His shoulders are stooped, as if literally wilting under the weight of recent events. And it goes beyond physical. His eyes remain on the floor. My father never walked into a room with his eyes down. Chief of Detectives Daniel Harney always held his chin up, the proud figure of authority and morality. A shudder passes through me. It's like our father is already gone, just as Patty said. I take Patty's hand and squeeze it.
Don't feel sorry for him, Patty whispers.
We're both fighting that instinct. Pop brought all this on himself. He deserves the fall he has taken, the humiliation, the disgrace, every last bit of it. But he is still our father. He is still our blood. We are tied to him forever. You don't flip a switch and turn that off.
How could you do it? I want to ask him. How could you shoot your own son?
I want so much to understand it, to see things through his eyes. I know I'm dreaming of something impossible. There is no justification. I only had a child for 3 years, but I would have done anything for her. I would have taken a bullet for her. Why didn't you feel the same thing for me?
Judge, with the obvious risk of flight and the corruption and murder charges that make the defendants eligible for the death penalty, the government requests no bond.
One of them, if not both, will cop a plea, I assume, and they'll give up Margaret. The feds like busting local cops, but they love getting local politicians. Whether it's Goldie or my father or both, Whatever deal they cut, they'll still spend the rest of their lives incarcerated. But they could avoid the death penalty and might get their choice of prisons. Pop and Goldie, standing before the judge, their backs to us, two broken, defeated men, listen as their lawyers express outrage at the notion of a no-bond order. The judge, on the other hand, doesn't seem so bothered by the thought. With a bang of the gavel, he orders each of them held without bond. And then just like that, it's over. My father and Goldie are led from the courtroom. The whole thing took less than 20 minutes. The clerk calls the next case. The reporters rush out, one of them passing by us, already on her cell phone, calling into her newsroom. No bond, she says into her phone. Held until trial, which means these boys will never see the light of day again. The way she said that, it hits both of us. Pop will spend the rest of his life in a federal penitentiary. We are both quiet, taking that in, as everybody else files out of the courtroom, leaving Patty and me alone. The room feels odd like this, without a judge or lawyers or spectators, like a naked tree in the winter. Then Patty says, well, on the bright side, it'll save us some money on Father's Day presents. I look at her, stunned. Then I burst out laughing. Don't ask me why. There's no script for how to handle shit like this. Patty and I will have plenty of ups and downs going forward. There'll be lots of dark days. We have both changed and will never be the same. But we are still here. We are still standing. And we are still family. 109. The hole in the wall, once my home away from home. Being here feels weird on many levels. One of which is that I'm here without Kate, my longtime partner, my friend, for a brief time more than that. My feelings for her, my memory of her, will always be complicated. She made life difficult for me at the end, but her heart was in the right place, even if her head was not. We never should have slept together. We never should have breached that wall. It colored everything. It made it harder for us to see what was going on around us. She deserved better. Patty spins on her bar stool and gives me the once-over as I approach. How are you doing? She asks. I shrug. I'm a washed-out cop with a questionable future. She points a finger at me as she raises her beer. But still a cop, she says. She seems happy that I've come out of this thing in one piece. Patty's always a mixed bag. A lot of work, but in the end, she was always looking out for me. Did she enjoy it on some level? Being the one helping me instead of the other way around? I'm sure she did. But in the end, what's the difference? She was there for me when it counted. Sosha, wearing a Hawks jersey, is so far into his pints that he can hardly stand. He falls into me and drapes an arm around my neck. This guy, he slurs to whomever is listening, which is nobody. Best cop I know. You're a good egg, Sosh, I say. Then I catch someone else's eye. She walks up to me with a coy smile, her eyes down. Well, 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 I say. Kim Beans, as I live and breathe. She looks up at me, the smile a bit brighter. You heard about Margaret, I take it. Of course I heard. It was Goldie. My father is too proud to admit anything, but Goldie caved. The feds took the death penalty off the table, and he gave up Margaret. The FBI perp-walked her out of the Daily Center 4 hours ago. Congratulations, she says. I raise my eyebrows and smirk at her. She nudges me with an elbow. Aw, you're not still sore at me, are you? I put a hand on my chest. Sore? Why would I be sore? Because you were receiving those weekly photographs from Margaret Olson and forgot to mention it, even though it would have cleared me? She wags a finger at me. Just exercising my rights under the First Amendment, she says. Yeah? I lean into her. Tell you what, Kim, maybe someday you and I will meet in a dark alley, and I'll exercise my rights under the Second Amendment. She deserves that, and she knows it. What does she care? This whole case rebuilt her career. She's back on TV and has a great future. Fair enough, she says. But if your attitude ever adjusts, detective, you've got my number. This time, it will be off the record. She gives me one last come-hither glance and walks away. Did she just come on to me? Whatever. I'm not touching that hot stove. I'm done with dangerous women. Never again. Not for a few weeks, at least. The truth is, in that particular department, I'm in a weird sort of limbo. My memory is back, which means my feelings for Amy have returned. I remember and feel it more than ever now, how deeply I cared for her. But it feels like another life to me. Like she's a warm, loving memory, but without the piercing heartache. It feels like I'm starting over now, a clean slate, for whatever that's worth. The crowd around me is filled with familiar faces, but in some ways foreign. There are nods and averted glances. Nobody knows how to deal with me. The scandal that has rocked the department will be felt for years. That's because of me. Three very popular cops, Kate, Goldie, and my father, are gone now, and in different ways they're all connected to me. I'm not exactly a pariah. Nobody can really blame me for anything. But I'm a symbol of the disaster, the last remaining freight car in the train wreck. My eyes fall on Lieutenant Paul Wisniewski, nursing a glass of rye at a table, the stub of an unlit cigar in his mouth. When our eyes meet, he pauses, removes the cigar from his mouth, takes a deep breath. The Wiz will always be an insufferable, self-promoting jackass, but he wasn't a crooked cop. I thought he was, and he thought I was. We were both reporting our findings to Goldie, the head of internal affairs. Goldie played each of us against the other, a virtuoso puppet show. I nod to the Wiz. He nods back. We will never be bosom buddies, but there is room for both of us in the department. And then I find myself climbing onto the stage and picking up the microphone. I click the mic on and stare out at the crowd. It takes a while for the noise to die down, but eventually it does, a nervous stillness hanging in the air, all eyes on me, the comedian, the guy whose name they used to chant. I just want to be a cop again, I say, surprising myself. That's all I ever wanted. You guys okay with that? Silence. I don't have anything else to say. I start to drop the mic. Then I hear somebody in the crowd clap his hands. Then someone else claps. Then others join in, a trickle of applause slowly gaining momentum. Pretty soon they're all on their feet, cheering and clapping. I wasn't expecting a standing ovation, but I'm getting one. I don't know if I'm gonna get back to where I was before this all happened. I'm not sure I want to. But wherever I am right now, a room full of cops letting me know that I'm one of them again is just fine with me for the present. Listen, I can't stay long, I say, raising a hand to quiet the crowd. I'm meeting Margaret Olson for drinks later. They like that. Howls of laughter. It probably helps that half of them can't stand Maximum Margaret, and the rest of them are so drunk they couldn't spell their own names. Just kidding, I say. But I have to say, my love life is doing okay these days. I'm losing track of all the women. In fact, you know what I could use? I look out over the crowd. I could really use a little black book. Laughter, even louder, hoots and shouts. I've been looking all over for mine, I say, and I'll be damned if I can find it. Please continue listening to hear an excerpt from James Patterson and Maxine Petro's 16th Seduction.
Chapter 1. That muggy morning in July, my partner, Rich Conklin, and I were on stakeout in the Tenderloin, one of San Francisco's sketchiest, most crime-ridden neighborhoods. We had parked our 1998 gray Chevy sedan where we had a good view of the six-story apartment building on the corner of Leavenworth and Turk. It's been said that watching paint dry was high entertainment compared with being on stakeout, but this was the exception to the rule. We were psyched and determined. We had just been assigned to a counterterrorism task force, reporting both to Warren Jacoby, chief of police, and also Dean Reardon, deputy director of Homeland Security based in D.C. This task force had been formed to address a local threat by a global terrorist group known as GAR that had claimed credit for six sequential acts of mass terrorism in the last 5 days. They were equal ethnicity bombers hitting three holy places, a mosque, a cathedral, and a synagogue, as well as 2 universities and an airport, killing more than 900 people of all ages and nationalities in 6 countries. As we understood it, GAR, Great Anti-Establishment Reset, had sprung from the rubble of Middle Eastern terror groups. Several surviving leaders had swept up young dissidents around the globe, including significant numbers of zealots from Western populations who'd cut their baby teeth in virtuality. The identities of these killers were undetectable within their home populations, since GAR's far-flung membership hid their activities inside the dark web, an internet underground perfect for gathering without meeting. Still, they killed real people in real life. And then, they bragged. After a year of burning, torturing, and blowing up innocent victims, GAR published their mission statement. They planned to infiltrate every country and bring down organized religion and governments and authorities of all types. Without a known supreme commander or national hub, blocking this open-source terrorism had been as effective as grasping poison gas in your hand. Due to GAR's unrelenting murderous activities, San Francisco, like most large cities, was on high alert on that 4th of July weekend. Conklin and I had been told very little about our assignment, only that one of the presumed GAR chiefs, known to us as Jay, had recently vaulted to the number one spot on our government's watch list. Over the last few days, Jay had been spotted going in and out of the dun-colored tenement on the corner of Turk and Leavenworth, the one with laddered fire escapes on 2 sides, and a lone tree growing out of the pavement beside the building's front door. Our instructions were to watch for him. If we saw him, we were to report his activities by radio, even as eyes in the skies were on this intersection from an AFB in Nevada or Arizona or Washington, D.C. When a male figure matching the grainy image we had of a bearded man, hat shading his face, 5'9", left the dun-colored apartment building, we took note. And when this character crossed to our side of the street and got into a white refrigerator van parked in front of the TL Market and Deli, we phoned it in. Conklin and I have been partners for 5 years and can almost read each other's minds. We looked at each other and knew that we couldn't just watch a suspected terrorist pull out into our streets without doing something about it. I said, "Following is watching." Rich said,
"Just a second, Lindsay, okay?"
His conversation with the deputy was short. Rich gave me the thumbs up, and I started up the car. We pulled out 2 car lengths behind the white van, driven by a presumed high-level terrorist known as Jay. Chapter 2. I edged our shark-like Chevy along Turk toward Hyde, staying just far enough behind Jay's van to stay out of his rear view while keeping an eye on him, until I lost the van at a stoplight on 10th Street. I had to make a split-second decision whether or not to run the light. My decision was go. My hands were sweating on the wheel as I shot through the intersection and was flamed by a cacophony of horn blasts which called attention to us. I didn't enjoy that at all. Conklin said,
"There he is."
The white van was hemmed in by other vehicles traveling at something close to the speed limit. I kept it in our sights from a good distance behind the pack. And then, 10th merged into US 101 South toward San Jose. The highway was a good, wide road, with enough traffic to ensure that Jay would never pick our Chevy out of the flow. Conklin worked the radio communications, deftly switching channels between Chief Warren Jacoby and DHS Deputy Director Dean Reardon, who was 3 time zones away. Dispatch kept us updated on the movements of other units in our task force, who were now part of a staggered caravan weaving between lanes, taking turns at stepping on the gas, then falling back. We followed Jay's van under the sunny glare on 101 South, and after 12 miles, instead of heading down the coast to San Jose and the Central Coast, he took the lane funneling traffic to SFO. Conklin had Jacoby on the line.
"Chief, he's heading toward SFO.
Several voices crackled over the radio, but I kept visual contact with the man in the van that was moving steadily towards San Francisco International Airport. That van was now the most frightening vehicle imaginable. GAR had sensitized all of us to worst-case scenarios, and a lot of explosives could be packed into a vehicle of that size. A terrorist wouldn't have to get on a plane or even walk into an airline terminal. I could easily imagine Jay crashing his vehicle through luggage check-in and ramming the plate glass windows before setting off a bomb. Conklin had signed off with Jacoby and now said to me,
Lindsay, SFO security has sent fire trucks and construction vehicles out to obstruct traffic on airport access roads in all directions.
Good. I stepped on the gas and flipped on the sirens. Behind us, others in our team did the same, and I saw flashing lights getting onto the service road from the north. Passenger cars pulled onto the verge to let us fly by, and within seconds we were passing Jay's van as we entered the international departure lane. Signs listing names of airlines appeared overhead. SFO's parking garage rose up on our right. Off-ramps and service roads circled and crossed underneath our roadway, which was now an overpass. The outline of the international terminals grew closer and larger just up ahead. Rich and I were leading a group of cars heading east to the airport when I saw cruisers heading away from the terminal right toward us. It was a high-speed pincer movement. Jay saw what was happening and had only two choices: keep going or stop. He wrenched his wheel hard to the right, and the van skidded across to the far right lane where there was one last exit to the garage, which 100 yards farther on had its own exit to South Link Road. The exit was open and unguarded. I screamed to Conklin, "Hang on!" I passed the white van on my right, gave the Chevy more gas and turned the wheel hard, blocking the exit. At the last possible moment, as I was bracing for a crash, Jay jerked his wheel hard left and pulled around us. By then, the airport roadway was filled with law enforcement cruisers, their lights flashing, sirens blowing. The van screeched to a halt. Adrenaline had sent my heart rate into the red zone and sweat sheeted down my body. My partner and I both asked if the other was okay as cop cars lined up both behind us and ahead of us, forming an impenetrable vehicular wall. A security cop with a megaphone addressed Jay.
Get out of the vehicle. Hands up. Get out now, buddy. No one wants to hurt you.
Would Jay go ballistic? I pictured the van going up in a fiery explosion 40 feet from where I sat in an old sedan. I flashed on the image of my little girl when I saw her this morning, wearing yellow, beating her spoon on the table. Would I ever see her again? Just then, the white van's passenger door opened and Jay jumped out. A voice amplified through a bullhorn boomed, "Don't move! Hands in the air!" Jay ignored the warning. He ran across the four lanes and reached the concrete guardrail. He looked out over the edge. He paused. There was nothing between him and the voluptuous curve of South Link Road but 40 feet of air. Shots were fired. I saw Jay jump. Rich shouted at me, "Get down!" We both ducked below the dash, linked our fingers over the backs of our necks as an explosion boomed, rocking our car, setting off the car alarm, blinding us with white light. That sick bastard had detonated his bomb. Chapter 3. Rich and I sat parked in the no parking zone outside the terminal, still reeling from what had happened an eighth of a mile from the airport terminals. We had seen Jay jump from the departures lane to a service road and knew that he had detonated his vest before he hit the pavement. We had tried to guess what he had been thinking. Our current theory was that he didn't want to be captured. He didn't want to talk. Conklin said,
"Maybe he figured jumping off the ramp, he'd land safely on a passing vehicle like he was in a Jackie Chan movie."
I jumped when someone leaned through the car window. It was Tom Generosa, counterterrorism chief, keeping us in the loop. He said,
"Here's what we know so far. The guy you called Jay had a plan to kill a lot of people inside a crowd, that's not in doubt. His vest was of the anti-personnel variety, packed with nails and ball bearings and rat poison. That's an anticoagulant. The explosion was meant to propel the shrapnel, and it did."
I nodded, and Generosa continued,
"The nails and shit shredded his body and any information he may have been carrying. He left a crater and a roadway full of human tissue and shrapnel.
And the van? I said.
Bomb squad cleared it. The FBI is loading it onto a flatbed, taking it to the crime lab. For starters, Jay stole the van from the market on Turk. Maybe his prints will be on the steering wheel, but I won't be surprised if he can't be positively ID'd.
Generosa told us that federal agents, as well as SFPD's crime scene unit, were at the site of the explosion now. That the CSU was processing it, and after it was measured, photographed, the remains of the man known as Jay would be transported by refrigerated van, along with explosive samples, to FBI and SFPD's forensic labs. Of course, we knew that Jay's bomb had shut down SFO. All airline passengers had been bussed to other locations. Outbound flights had been grounded, and incoming flights rerouted to other airfields. We could see for ourselves that the terminal buildings were crawling with a multitude of law enforcement agents from CIA, FBI, DHS, airport security, and their bomb-sniffing dogs. Generosa couldn't estimate with any certainty how long SFO would be out of commission. But as bad as that was for the airlines, their passengers, and traffic, GAR hadn't scored a hit in San Francisco today. We thanked Generosa for the report. He told us,
"Take good care,"
and walked over to the next car in the line behind us. We were about to call in for further instructions when our radio sputtered and Jacoby's voice filled our car. He said,
"You two are something else, you know? You cut Jay off from his target. Thank God for that."
I said, "Man, oh man, I can't stand to imagine it." But I did imagine it. I pictured an airport in Paris. I pictured another in Turkey. I could easily see what might have gone down at SFO if Jay had gotten into or even near a terminal. When I first started in homicide, an airport bombing was inconceivable. Now, these horrifying bombings were almost becoming commonplace. Jacoby's voice was still coming over the radio. He said,
"Effective as soon as you turn in your report. You two are off duty. Boxer, Conklin, I'm proud of you. I love you both. Thanks from me and from Deputy Reardon, and a lot of people who never heard of you and never will. Many lives were saved. Stand down. Come home. The feds are going to take it from here."
I was shaking with relief when I turned the car keys over to Conklin. I got into the passenger seat. I leaned back and closed my eyes as he drove us back to the hall. Chapter 4. It was our wedding anniversary. Also our first date night since Joe and I had separated 6 months ago. Joe had surprised me, calling me up as I was leaving work, saying,
"I reserved a window table. Say yes, Lindsay. I'm parked right outside."
I'd given in, and now we were at the Crested Cormorant, the hot new seafood restaurant on Pier 9 with a front row seat on the San Francisco Bay. Candles flickered on tables around us as a pink sunset colored the sky to the horizon, tinting the rippling water as the mist rolled in. Joe was talking about his youngest brother.
"So at age 40, Petey finally meets the love of his life at a fire department car wash," he laughed. "Amanda was power washing his white walls, and somehow that jumpstarts his heart."
"You think her t-shirt got wet?" Joe laughed again. I love his laugh. He said,
"Very possibly. We're invited to their wedding in Cozumel next month. Think about it, okay?"
Looking into my husband's eyes, I saw how much he wanted to bring us back to our wedding 3 years ago in a gazebo overlooking Half Moon Bay. We'd vowed in front of dear friends and family to love each other from that day forward. It had been a promise I knew I could keep. But I hadn't been able to see around corners. Not then. Now, in this romantic setting, Joe was hoping for magic to strike again. As for me, my innocence was gone. I wished it weren't so. Our waiter set a Dungeness crab platter down in front of me. As I stared at a pair of claws, a metaphor jumped into my mind. I was on the horns of a dilemma. Should I reach across the table, squeeze Joe's hand, and tell him to come home? Or was it time for us both to admit that our Humpty Dumpty marriage couldn't be put back together again? Joe lifted his wine glass and said,
"To happy days."
Just then, there was a sharp sound, as if the world had cracked open, followed by the boom of rolling thunder and a bright flash on the neighboring pier. I screamed, "No!" I grabbed Joe's arm and stared open-mouthed as I looked across to the water to Pier 15, the site of a science museum called the Exploratorium. It was a massive geometric glass and steel structure designed for human interaction with the past and especially the future. As I stared, the structure was unfolding like a bud bursting into bloom right in front of my eyes. Metal panels flew toward us, a mushroom cloud formed over Pier 15, and an overarching hail of glinting glass shards fell into the bay. Joe said, "Jesus, what the hell?" His expression perfectly mirroring the horror I felt. Another bomb. The Exploratorium was open to the public 7 days a week, but to adults only on Thursday nights. This was Thursday, wasn't it? Yes. People were inside the museum. Was this a GAR attack? Had to be. Joe threw down a credit card, stabbed at his phone, and called his job. Similarly, I called SFPD dispatch and reported what looked to be a mass casualty incident. "There's been an explosion with fire at the Exploratorium, Pier 15. Send all cars, FD, bomb squad, ambulances, and find Lieutenant Brady. Tell him I'm on the scene." Joe said,
"Lindsay, wait here. I'll be back."
"You're kidding.
You want to get killed?
Do you?" I followed Joe out of the restaurant onto the walkway that ran the length of the pier. We stood for a long moment at the railing and watched the Exploratorium's two-story metal frame structure crumple as the roof caved in. The sight was devastating and almost impossible to take in, but it was real. The Exploratorium had been blown up. Joe and I started running.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Black Book, written by James Patterson and David Ellis, read by Eduardo Ballerini, produced and directed by Cheryl Smith, recorded by Amar Jess, post-production by Beat Street Productions. The Black Book is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2017 by James Patterson. Audio production copyright 2017 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental. Audible.